Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past. Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Tea Break Time Travel. I am your host, Matilda Siebrecht. Today I am savoring a chai latte. I went a bit lazy on this one and I'm just using the chai latte powder with some milk. But you know what? It tastes delicious, so I don't care. And joining me on my tea break today is professional archaeologist Aaron Dieter Wolf. And are you also drinking tea, coffee, anything, any hot beverage?
I am. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I am going ginger turmeric today. I think it's supposed to help me with stress. Oh. And I don't know if it's doing that or not, but, you know, every little bit helps, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, ginger and turmeric are also supposed to be really good for warding off colds and stuff, right? Which at time of year is probably a good thing as well. It can't hurt. Yeah, exactly. And are you generally, so that's sort of more of a, well, I don't even know if that would count as herbal, because herbal to me is always like chamomile, but you're not necessarily a black tea drinker. You go with like more the fruity concoctions.
I am all over the place. I don't really have a favorite, honestly. Most days I start out with coffee and then it sort of depends on how the day is going. If I make it off of coffee onto other things.
Fair enough. And your coffee is standard black coffee? Is it a fancy chai, espresso, latte, macchiato, caramel?
I am a latte guy. Yep. Okay. I enjoy the espresso and the milk. Yep.
Yeah. Well, also always good. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate it, especially if it sounds like it's a stressful time at the moment. Hopefully this takes away some of the stress rather than adding more to it. So of course you are a professional archaeologist. You work in the sort of archaeological cultural heritage sector. And of course, you do sort of independent research, which we'll get into in a second. But in terms of the kind of archaeology, what actually got you into archaeology in the first place? I always ask my guests this, and every single time it's been a completely different answer. So I'm very curious how the inspiration hit you.
Sure. Yeah. So in high school, I guess it was late high school, my family took a trip to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And I was introduced to the Maya ruins at that time. Oh. And that would have been in 1991 or 1992. And so it was not quite sort of the tourist mecca that it's become now. Sort of a much earlier, more sort of rustic, I guess, experience. And that really got me thinking about archaeology. And then freshman year of college, I took a Maya art and archaeology course. And decided that this was a thing I wanted to do.
But how come you then didn't sort of continue? Did you decide not to continue in Mayan archaeology, or did you just get drawn into other topics then?
So a little bit of both. So the school that I attended, my college, did not actually have an archaeology degree. They only had classical archaeology as a minor. And so I actually came out of undergrad with an art history degree, of all things, and then went to graduate school to study Maya archaeology and worked for a couple of field seasons in Belize and Guatemala, excavating on Maya sites, and eventually realized that there were too few jobs for my archaeologists and too many people who already had PhDs in the profession.
Right.
And so I sort of changed focus and started working in cultural resource management here in the American Southeast.
Okay, but the work that you were doing in South America was sort of research-focused excavation things rather than the cultural heritage pool.
Yeah, it was academic archaeology. So at that stage, because I was still a graduate student, I was working on other people's projects. And mm-hmm. so they were projects at specific sites, understanding the initial chronologies of some of these sites. You're doing sort of first on the ground excavations, trying to reconstruct when exactly these sites spanned and, you know, which communities live there and how they relate to the other communities in the periphery.
Okay. And in terms of, so my personal experience in terms of excavation is indeed that kind of excavation. So research excavations, and then also working for, say, a commercial company who, you know, they're building a car park, they find a wall, we're sent in to dig up the wall, and then they build the car park. So, but in terms of cultural resource management, especially in the US, seems to be a really big thing. What would you say are the kind of major differences in that sphere, in that line of work, compared to kind of excavation archaeology?
Well, I think it's very similar to what you described with the car park, okay. Right? So cultural resource management is sort of the shorthand for archaeology as business and compliance. Mm-hmm. And so I did that work for about seven or eight years after graduate school. Mm-hmm. And that's going out ahead of projects that are required to do federal or state level compliance or environmental permitting. So if a project receives state level permitting or federal permitting or receives federal money, one of their requirements may be to do environmental studies. And, you know, that looks at endangered species, it looks at watersheds, it looks at pollution, it looks at archaeology. And so we were out doing exactly that work, you know, walking the path of a future transmission line and digging a hole every 30 meters.
Yeah, that's basically what we're doing now in the company. Yeah. As well. Yep. It's like, oh, joy. Yeah. Oh, another hole. Oh, great.
Yeah. <Here it is. laughs> Yeah. And so I did that for about 7 years or 7 to 10 years or so, and then was in sort of the right place at the right time when a job opened here at the Tennessee Division of Archaeology, which is the state of Tennessee's archaeology wing. And so we're part of this big environment and conservation umbrella. And that's everything, again, from, you know, stream water and species to state parks and recreation. And archaeology is a very small cog in that wheel.
Okay. And so do you still dig, or is it mainly the kind of more administrative side? Well, administrative makes it sound small, but you know what I mean? Like the policy and that kind of side.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room for full-scale excavation anymore. There are, 36,000 or so recorded sites in Tennessee. And at this point, I'm the only prehistoric archaeologist with our group.
Okay.
So there's more that could be dug than I could possibly dig. And okay. So our focus is much more in a conservation and preservation side of things.
Mm. Okay. Do you miss the digging?
Sometimes, you know, sometimes I do. Sometimes my back is just as happy that I'm not out there doing it anymore.
I went out to an excavation site for the first time in ages the other week, because I'm mainly doing the documentation and kind of communication side of things at the company. But I went and did some actual digging because I was like, yeah, I have a few hours. Why not? And oh my gosh, my knees and my legs and my back the day after. I was like, yep, no, this is why I prefer lab work.
Yep. Yes. Bad, the permanent farmer's tan. Yes, all of it.
As well. It's like the tinnitus from all the wind just whipping through yes. your ears all the time. Yeah. Yeah, basically. So alongside your job as state archaeologist or an archaeologist within the state.
There you go. Yep.
The state archaeologist sounds so much, you know.
He's my boss. Yeah.
Ah, okay. No, that's fine. He might not listen to this podcast. he might never know. You also have become the kind of world's authority, one might say, on the archaeology of tattooing, which is something that we're going to talk about today. Usually I try and give a bit more of a spoiler, but seeing as we chatted with Daniel last week and I said we were going to talk to you about tattooing last month, I mean, and we said we were going to talk with you about tattooing this month, I feel it's not really a spoiler. So how did that come about from a background in kind of excavation and Mayan? How did tattooing become a thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, for starters, you're being really generous, and I appreciate that. You know, I don't consider myself the expert on anything. I know a few things, but, you know, that's the result of having been reading for a decade and, you know, having formed some very close friendships with practitioners, with people like Danny and, you know, indigenous practitioners and full-time tattooists. And, you know, it takes a village to do good research. And, you know, I don't think any of us sort of stand on our own in that regard. But all of that aside, yeah, I got interested in the topic back while I was still doing my archaeology. My first tattoos that I got were in graduate school were of Maya glyphs. Oh. And, you know, I think a lot of archaeologists get tattoos of the things they're studying, particularly in graduate school.
And, it's like a good form of CV. Like, yeah. It's an easier way. You just turn up to your interview and say, look, this is what I'm studying.
That's right. Yes. So put it on the front page of your CV. Yeah. But, you know, everybody, there's kind of a general awareness that the Maya, you know, engaged in a lot of different kinds of body modification. Ooh. And, you know, while you're working there, you're finding tools, you're finding obsidian blades that, you know, or stingray spines, things that you know are associated with body modification. And, you know, I thought about it a little bit at the time just because of myself having those tattoos and, you know, other graduate students and talking about it. But then when I switched focus to working here in the American Southeast, that sort of followed me in the back of my head for a number of years. And I started getting interested in this question of, if tattooing was happening in the past, why aren't we finding it archaeologically? Good. And particularly when you look at the first accounts of European and Native American interactions all along the eastern seaboard of the United States, starting in, let's say, the 15th, 16th centuries, an incredible number of those accounts describe that the Native Americans who were encountering the Europeans, that the Native Americans were heavily tattooed. And the language isn't quite there yet. So, you know, the word tattoo wasn't part of the European lexicon yet. But you have these accounts where, you know, Spanish authors will describe that Native men in Florida had these designs on their skin which were pricked in with thorns and so could never be erased. Oh, and you're like, okay, well, you know, okay, they're talking about tattooing there, right? Yeah.
Fair. So yes, it was pretty clear indeed that they were referring to tattoos of these cultures that they were experiencing and that they were meeting.
Yeah, exactly. And there's art from the region that suggests tattooing was practiced at least several hundred years prior to the arrival of Europeans. And so, you know, as an archaeologist working in this area, this got me interested in the question of, well, if people were doing this, if people were practicing tattooing, then why weren't we finding the artifacts of that practice? Where was the material culture? And at that time, there had been, you know, maybe a dozen identifications over two centuries of possible tattooing implements from North America. And, you know, this really bugged me, right? I mean, the thing about archaeology is, we think we're interpreting the past. We think we're understanding people's behaviors and what they did and how they, you know, saw themselves in their societies and in their environments. And here's this entire behavior, this entire aspect of human culture that we were apparently just blind to. And, you know, the great thing about doing independent research is that you're not hemmed in then by geographic constraints or, you know, institutional constraints. And so I, you know, in working on this question for North America, it sort of became clear that this is an issue all over the world.
Yeah.
That, you know, we know the ancient Egyptians tattooed. We don't know what tools they used to do it, you know. And so then how do we solve that problem? And that's sort of been this through line that runs through my research then, is this idea of, you know, A, why have we overlooked this? And B, how can we be better about this?
Exciting. Well, we're going to talk more about that in a second. But first of all, of course, one more question I have to ask you, as this is Tea Break Time Travel. If you could travel back in time, where would you go and why?
You know, I don't think I have a good answer for that. There's so much of the past that would be amazing to see, and so many different places and so many different cultures. You know, for my own research, being able to go back into the mid-Holocene in the southeastern United States would be amazing. You know, for any reason you could possibly think of, going back to see the ancient Maya would be incredible.
Yeah.
You know, there's all of these cultures that, you know, we as archaeologists, I think, really appreciate, but don't really understand in that first person sort of way. Yeah. And so getting to see any of them would be a privilege.
I mean, it could, there's a slight stereotype, right, for Americans and Australians, tourists coming to Europe, that you do a tour of the whole of Europe, you know, and spend one day in each place. So that could be a similar yes. thing for going back in time, right? Like you do a tour
there you
of
go.
The whole time
there
period.
There you go. Just... the worst time travel tourist ever.
Get all of the highlights. Okay, back on the bus.
Yeah, yes.
That sounds, I mean, why not? That sounds, if we ever right. do then time travel.
On to Giza.
Yeah. Exactly. Cool. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me in my tea break today. So before we talk a little bit more about tattooing and the research surrounding it, we're going to journey back to the Pazaruk Valley. I apologize in advance for any butchering that I do of that pronunciation. Aaron can correct me in a moment. In the Altai Mountains of Siberia, somewhere in the middle of the 4th century BC. It's dusk. There's the clicking and purring sounds of insects and other wildlife fills the air above the wide plains. Before us stands a huge pile of freshly dug soil heaped around the smooth stones of a tomb. In front of the mound, a crowd of people are gathered, some holding flaming torches, others bearing wreaths of woven hair and grass. They watch in silence as a procession approaches, several figures holding aloft a stretcher on which lies a muscled, middle-aged man. Although he's wrapped in expensive cloths, one arm lies uncovered along his side, revealing several elaborate, swirling tattoos in the form of different animals. They seem to dance in the flickering firelight, but then the procession moves into the tomb and the animals fall still. I may have been slightly inspired when I was looking at the pictures. So how do you pronounce that correctly, Aaron? Do you know?
I do not know.
Okay, good. That makes me feel better.
You have to ask Gino.
Okay, perfect. I'll ask Gino and he can comment on this podcast when it's released and go, ugh, you guys, you don't know anything. So yeah, so these are, of course, the famous mummies, Pazaruk, mummies that were found in the caves in Siberia. And so we're going to talk today about tattoos. And we already spoke a bit with Danny last week about tattooing materials and the kind of tools and the methods and the techniques that are used. But we have Aaron here today to tell us a little bit more about the tattoos themselves and the research that goes into them. So we'll get a bit more into the details into the next section. But first, of course, we always have to look at the most asked questions on the internet, which, as I said to Danny, there was surprisingly little about tattooing, actually, when you did a sort of Google autofill search thing. There's very little about, especially ancient tattooing, which just, I think, proves your point that you said that we're not interested enough in past tattooing, apparently. So, of course, the main questions were all about origins. So, for example, when did the tattooing start and who did the first tattoos? Can you enlighten us at all about this?
Boy, wouldn't it be great to be able to answer those.
Right?
Yeah, we'll start with the small questions. Let's start with the really small ones, right? We don't know. There just are not enough data points yet. Mm. You know, we know tattooing as a practice goes back at least 5,000 years. That's the earliest direct evidence so far. If it goes back 5,000 years, it goes back further. We just don't have the archaeological or historical evidence to talk about it in those terms yet. And as for who is doing it, again, I don't think we know enough to really say. You know, we can take historical cultures and, you know, based on what we know about them, project into the past. And that's, you know, that's one way of looking at how people behave in the past, but it also comes with some dangers, right? You're projecting these things over time and space. And the further you go from the cultures you're using, the more error you're incurring. Mm-hmm. But doing that, I think we would intuit that the people doing the tattooing were not just every dude around the campfire, right? That these were practices that were probably done by healers, by shaman, by ritual practitioners, because of all of the things that were tied in with them, because of the sacred symbols, because of the letting of blood, that it was not just a casual thing that was done.
Okay. So it's assumed that it was sort of part of some kind of, I hate to use the word ritual, but you know what I mean. I'm in terms of ritual.
Look, we're archaeologists. If we don't understand it, we call it ritual. You know how this works.
I do. I just like to pretend I don't do it, but who knows? Right. I definitely do it. But so it would likely have occurred, I suppose, around the same time that maybe ornamentation or kind of that we see evidence for other forms of decoration starting, would you say? Or do you think that it could have even been earlier than that?
Right. I mean, boy, that would be cool, right? I mean, you know, body decoration is one of the, what do they call it, the behavioral bees, right? It's one of those traits that allegedly makes biologically modern humans different from our cousins. You know, it's what makes us supposedly stand out from, you know, Homo erectus and all these other individuals who were roaming around the landscape before us. And, you know, as soon as humans become human, we start decorating stuff. We start making beads. We start, you know, processing ochres for pigments. Like it's really deeply embedded in who we are as a creature. And, you know, sure, right? I mean, what's it take to get that first accidental tattoo? You know, when you are around a campfire and get, you know, poked by the piece of wood with charcoal on it, and that mark never goes away.
This was actually a really interesting point that Daniel raised last month, in that one theory that he had from his mentor was that it was during the butchering process, because you're covered in all this sort of fat, and then that gets mixed up with the soot of the fire as you're processing, and then you have these sharp obsidian blades, so you just automatically get little cuts and nicks everywhere, and then somehow that turns into tattoos, which I really like that theory.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I think it's, I mean, obviously people are going to be aware of the possibility of human skin holding pigment because of accidents like that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the point at which people then have complex symbolism, if you're painting something on cave walls and it's, you know, semi-permanent, or if you're painting it on bodies and it's semi-permanent, how much better and more important is it to put those same designs on skin in a way that they don't go away, in a way that's there until the person dies. Yeah. And so I think it's a quick step to the side to reach this idea of scarification or tattooing.
But the short answer is we don't know when tattooing started or who did the first one. Good. Well, now that we've covered that, let's have a very quick break, and we will be back soon.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome back, everyone. So we know, well, we don't actually know any more about tattoos. We just know how much we don't know about tattoos. But so maybe we can discuss even more that we don't know about tattoos. Well, no, let's start with something that we do know. So, for example, how many examples, and I mean, this might be a bit too specific a question, so feel free to interpret it as you wish, but how many examples of actual ancient tattoos do we have, like, that we can surely say that is a tattoo?
More than you would think.
Nice.
So one of my side projects is the Tattooed Human Mummy Database. And so this is a thing where it's an open source database where I just keep track of all of the published examples of tattoos from the ancient past. Mm-hmm. So these are things that are preserved on human skin, deliberately or accidentally mummified human skin. And I think at last count, we're up to about 50 or so archaeological sites on five or so continents.
Wow, and that's sites even, not even sites. Necessarily individuals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's actual identifiable sites. And then beyond that, there are, you know, there's sort of this indefinite body of preserved tattoos that come from things like historical sources, where, you know, maybe a British writer traveling in Sudan just, you know, in the 1800s writes this offhand thing about, and in the cemetery near such and such, all of the mummies had tattoos.
Right.
And you're like, okay, well, you know, like,
great,
so what, we don't know what site that is, and we don't know what all of the mummies, you know, is this being one? Does it mean 500? So, you know, there's that kind of error in there.
Mm.
But, you know, that number is increasing constantly. And, you know, there have been more identifications of preserved tattoos in the past decade than there were in the century before that.
Mm. And in terms of the kind of technology that's used to identify tattoos, because I believe Danny mentioned something about using kind of infrared, and that could then show you tattoos that hadn't been seen before. Like, what is the sort of process of tattoos being hidden that we can now get to? Or are there some processes that we haven't worked out how to kind of interpret yet?
Yeah, you know, infrared and multispectral imaging are the big ones, or the big tools in that kit. And those work, you know, even if you can't see the tattoo visibly, right? The human epidermis, depending on the preservation conditions, skin might darken, it might twist, it might lay over itself. You know, parts of it may degrade more than others. It may be covered with body paint or with clothing or other things. Mm-hmm. And so there are certainly examples of preserved human remains that have not been identified as being tattooed, but that might be. Mm-hmm. And the way the multispectral imaging or the infrared imaging works, it basically relies on the fact that tattoo pigment absorbs and reflects light in these spectra, in these different spectra, differently than untattooed skin does. And so even if the surface of the skin is, say, you know, a dark brown, a rich mahogany brown from being exposed to the desert for centuries, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When you look at it in the near infrared spectrum, that light will absorb and reflect differently on the tattooed skin and the non-tattooed skin. And so you can see those marks. Even after all those years, I mean, there were examples when Danny and I were working in that collection of Andean remains where we would point the camera at an arm or a body part that had no visible sign. And all of a sudden you're looking at not just like single dots, but, you know, complex compositions of tattoos encircling the whole arm that would otherwise never have been noticed.
How did you get any actual work done? I would have just been squealing the whole time. Like, oh my God, did you see that? Yes, I can see it.
There's a lot of that. It's like any archaeological project. It starts out with giddiness and you're ready to go. You're going to do all these things. And by like day four, you're kind of on like the death march. You're like, oh my God, we've got 200 more to go. We're never going to get through this.
Another tattoo. Oh, yay.
Great. Let's document this one, I guess.
We've run out of recording sheets.
But I mean, amazing. Amazing that that's, I assume this is, by the way, being written up and will be published some point soon, or will
hopefully sooner than later. Actually, there's a German colleague who is working on the question of Andean remains in European museum collections for his dissertation.
Okay.
And so we've been collaborating, and publication of a lot of this may wait until after his dissertation is out so as not to interrupt that process.
Fair enough. Are we allowed to know who it is in case people want to look?
Sure. Yeah. Robin Gerst. G-E-R-S-T is his name. Yeah. He's in Germany, and he's actually presented at the World Mummy Congress, and he and I co-authored a paper at the recent European Archaeological Association or European Society of Archaeology. I never can remember what the EAA meeting.
I should know it. I was there the last one as well. But yeah, fantastic. Oh, so you've got, you know, your own tattooing apprentice now.
No. Collaborator.
Oh, that's very, But yeah. And in terms of when you were interpreting these tattoos then, because as you said, the skin's all twisted or it's dark or it's thing, how much kind of imagination is needed? I think I saw at some point recently you posted on your social media about kind of some alpha and omega sign that had been identified, and you were saying that's a bit of a stretch of the imagination. I mean, how much bias is there, would you say, in the interpretation of that, or how can you avoid that, I guess?
Oh, it's hard, right? I mean, I think it's like any sort of art history or any sort of, you know, working with ancient symbolism, especially on artifacts, there's all different levels of preservation. And, you know, the best cases, you can just look at these things and see them with the naked eye and they're incredible and you can draw them out by hand very easily. And in the worst cases, you know, skin is degraded or pieces are missing, or the marks themselves have interruptions in them from curation processes or from preservation processes. And yeah, a lot of it can be sort of art rather than science, right? Honestly.
And did you find, for example, when you were looking at this sort of big collection of different mummies, that you would sort of see some symbols on one and go, oh, I'm not sure what that is. Okay, maybe it's kind of this. And then maybe you'd see the same symbols on another one, or was it all quite varied?
No, absolutely. So again, it sort of works like any form of ancient art. You know, after you look at a couple thousand of the thing,
another squiggly snake.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You had a pretty good ability to sort of pick out, you know, based on the outlines, based on the shared sizes and, you know, sort of ephemeral shapes, you can more closely, I think, sort of push things into buckets. You know, this one's probably a fish based on these other 500 fish we've seen.
Right. Interesting. And in terms of, we've kind of spoken a little bit about how, like, why these tattoos would have come about and how they would have come about, but they, like you say, they're sort of their art. Do you think that people tattooed just simply as a form of decoration, or would there be other kind of reasons, I suppose, for painting themselves with these different symbols or, yeah, pictures, I guess.
My bet is that it was rarely a personal form of decoration. Now, you know, of course, everybody wants tattoos on your body, it becomes part of your identity, right? Mm-hmm. Regardless of how it was that it, what the cultural processes were that got it there. But again, mm-hmm. based on what we know about historical, you know, pre-Western tattooing and projecting into the past, our expectation is that these are things that were not necessarily selected by the individual, but were given to them by value of who they were in the society, by, you know, honors they had earned, by who their parents were, by what their lineage was, by the individual who was doing the tattooing. You know, that's sort of what we expect, is that there wasn't the same idea of people just picking things out and getting them.
Now, that's, you know, pretty. I want the butterfly.
Right. Now, having said that, you know, for example, I've seen so many tattoos from the Andes now that have such a wide variety, such a huge variation, and no two of them are the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'll see the same motifs, but blocked into completely different, you know, within completely different sleeves, right? Compositions that run all the way from the knuckles up to the elbow. Oh. And so I don't quite know how to explain that. You know, a year ago, yeah, I would have said, oh yeah, no, everybody's just getting what they're given. But then you see that much variation in a sample and you say, well, you know, maybe not, right? Maybe this is the exception that proves the rule.
And I guess I'm trying to think of other forms of decoration. I suppose it's similar in that you have the same kind of, I'm trying to think of, like, there's, I can't remember now which culture it is. In Africa, there's a culture which I remember have different beaded necklaces, and the necklace said whether you were married, whether you had children, whether you, you know, like, depending on how many you had. And so obviously, you know, the more necklaces you had, the more kind of higher your social status was, because it showed that you had all these different kind of tasks completed, I guess, in that way. But still, the necklaces were all different, but they were still the beaded necklaces, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and with clothing or any other form of body decoration, you know, in some cases, it is socially mandated. You know, the headdresses look the same and only certain people get them. But in other cases, there's a lot of variation and a lot more individuality, agency in those choices.
Yeah. Or even just something, I'm thinking something even more modern, like, you know, a tie. It's like, yes, you have to wear a tie to work, but everyone has different ties.
No one said it couldn't have cats on it.
Exactly. So, you know, no, you have to get this type of tattoo. Well, no one said it had to be that, because it's a type of tattoo.
Right.
I could alter it a little bit. And would you say then that all cultures, because like you say, more and more examples of ancient tattoos are sort of coming to light every day. And we have all these historic and ethnographic references which state that a lot of these cultures in the past and present, I suppose, had tattoos. Would you say that all cultures had some form of tattooing tradition or other kind of body modification?
Boy, that's a limb to go out on, isn't it? Right? All cultures.
Or, you know, would you say a large percentage likely had it, I guess? Because it's one of those things that I suppose you don't really think about, like you say, unless you are forced to think about it, you know? But
right. Well, so one of the projects that my buddy Ben Robitaille and I have been working on over the years is, you know, mapping out tool forms, you know, accounts of tattooing technologies on this global scale. And when you look at that map, I mean, it is really inching towards every piece of habitable land to where we have these accounts from. I mean, I increasingly think that, like you said, more cultures than not had some form of tattooing. Now, it wasn't always positive, right? I mean, empires seem to hate tattooing.
Huh.
And, you know, that's sort of an interesting thread in the histories as well, is that these large empires, whether it's, you know, the Western colonialism or Han China or the Inca, those are groups that may use tattooing, but they use it for negative reasons.
Right.
Whereas the groups on their periphery use tattooing as marks of inclusion, of being a part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's always that tension of, like, you know, some groups, once it's on the skin of a person or a group, it becomes a mark of belonging.
Yeah.
But the people next door to them, those same marks are a mark of of the outsider, of the other.
Belonging, but in a bad way.
Yes. Yeah. And so particularly, I think then when you have these, you know, political structures that are trying to suppress individuality and sort of bring in these regional cultures under the umbrella of, you know, the one big culture, capital C. One of the things they do is they suppress individuality, they suppress language, they suppress traditional dress, they suppress traditional religion and body decoration of all forms.
Because, yeah, I guess it shows an individuality that, or a kind of part of something that shouldn't be its own individuality anymore. It should be part of the bigger. Yeah,
exactly. Bigger, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And in that sense, do you then see, if we imagine that a lot of different cultures had these tattoos, but in terms of what you've seen so far with your research or in terms of what you've read, are there kind of regional or temporal trends? I imagine there must be. I mean, there wasn't, I guess it's like one, it's like anything. It's like stone tools. They just appeared everywhere all over the world. I suppose like tattooing, they just appeared everywhere. And, you know, what are there sort of a lot of similarities that you see? Do you see a lot of differences in the symbolism? How, I don't know, how does it vary, I suppose, over place and time?
I think you saying about stone tools is exactly right. You know, it's there are ceramics, there are stone tools everywhere, but the specifics of that are going to vary depending on the group in question, you know, their relationship with groups outside of themselves, how isolated or connected they are to networks, to trade networks, what material culture they have in their local environment to work with. And, you know, again, you can sort of envision this in terms of art styles too, right? The art of certain cultures is going to be similar, although not exact. Whereas then if you compare that to a culture on the other side of the world, well, you know, maybe they use two straight lines to symbolize a path. Or, you know, vertical lines mean rain, but otherwise there's going to be an entirely different set of symbols attached to it.
Yeah. And in terms of then kind of comparing it with the art, do you find that in those cases where you have access to examples of both kind of other forms of art and the tattoos, do you see similarities in the, like, are they tattooing themselves with what they're also painting the walls with or carving into their stone or something like that?
Not necessarily with the same tools, but definitely with the same motifs, right? There's a couple of papers that talk about this in terms of like scarification in Africa and how the decorations on people's bodies are reflected on pots, on ceramic vessels.
Okay.
And the locations are very similar, right? We sort of anthropomorphize ceramic vessels. They have shoulders, they have mouths, they have waists. And so the decorations tend to match up for where they are on pots and where they are on people's bodies.
Interesting.
I heard someone once talk about the idea that things that are marked onto the earth, so petroglyphs, cave art, things like this, that those oftentimes appear then also as tattoos in the culture. And the idea that this, I can't remember who this was now, I apologize, but the idea that they were floating was sort of this idea of like, you know, again, we anthropomorphize the earth, right? It is the earth mother, it's the earth being. And so the things that you are marking onto the earth, you are also then marking onto the body of people.
Amazing. I mean, it could almost be like a little, not CV, what is it? Portfolio, you know, as well. Like, these are designs. It's just like the original tattoo studio. You go, that's what the caves were.
Well, I was going to say, Danny, a year from now, will hang up a flash in a French cave.
Danny's designs were being used.
He's
now being inspired again. That would be hilarious if the different caves, Lascaux and everything, you know, were actually just sitting there going, these are my options. Oh, you want the bison? Yeah, sure.
I mostly do rhinoceroses and birds.
Well, that guy does the lions. You want to go to that cave? He'll do the lions for you. I mean, I like that idea. I'm sort of practicing it first on the earth and then or vice versa, I suppose. It could have been vice versa. Let me practice on my own body first before I, you know, carve it into Mother Nature. But no, that's really interesting. And you've already mentioned it a little bit, but I thought it would be interesting to talk a bit more about who does the tattooing, because I remember I had you and Maya Sialuk on the X-Talk show, another podcast that I do, and we chatted about tattooing. And she was talking about, of course, the Inuit tradition of tattooing, which is mainly done by women, for example. And it's sort of one of these things, a bit like you were saying earlier, in that you had to kind of earn it from the community. It wasn't necessarily something that you kind of selfishly got to do yourself, if that makes sense. And you mentioned earlier that you think it might have been more the shamans or the sort of ceremonial figures, I guess, in the community who would have been doing it rather than just everyone. Is there kind of a reason for your thinking about that, or what ideas do you have about that? Yeah.
Well, I think that is largely based on historical analogy, and that is the thing that we see throughout the pre-modern world, where we have, you know, reliable historical accounts, is that the people doing the tattooing held a special status. And that wasn't always, you know, quote unquote, ritual status. You know, they might have been itinerant tattooists traveling from village to village, but it was not just something that was done, you know, by your mom or by anybody, you know, by your buddies in the basement. it was something that there was this whole framework around. And, you know, it's really hard to talk about, you know, ritual in the past, right? Because some of it may be related to cosmology or to how you view the world or how you see spirits, but some of it may be just related to health concerns. You know, tattooing involves the piercing of the skin, the letting of blood. It is a process in which you are open to infection, right? This is a high risk sort of behavior. And so I think that part of why it tends to be done by specialists is because these are people who are versed in the taboos and the traditions. And, you know, some of those taboos may be purely social, right? You don't eat this animal while you're giving the tattoos, but others of them about, you know, what happens afterwards and how the tattoos are treated and, you know, this kind of thing relate to health and to healing and to these ideas of helping a person get through this process.
Oh, yeah. Which, relates to a lot of other, I guess, kind of folklore and things in different parts of the world and in different time periods as well, right? It's that kind of a lot of the superstitions and all of the kind of myths and legend and everything are actually indeed just related to be like, yes, and after you have done this, you have to drink the water of a moonbeam 3 liters every day, you know, because it is sort of like, well, yeah, you need to hydrate, you know, basically. And
in my mind, too, this is why I think that a lot of tattooing traditions historically are connected to rites of passage. You know, if you were just kind of wave your hand across the globe, many, 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 maybe most traditions are related to ideas like coming of age or becoming an adult or, you know, transitioning from the uninitiated to the initiated, right? It's this liminal process where you come out the other side and you've got marks on your body that show the world that you are now this other thing.
And I guess remind yourself as well that you are.
And that may be that you're an adult, right? It can be simple as like, oh, they're an adult. Or it may be, oh, they're a marked warrior. They, you know, they have access to these other things, whatever. But, you know, these rites of passage, which again, you know, there's a lot of issues surrounding those sorts of events that, you know, they're supposed to be painful, they're supposed to be difficult, but you're also supposed to live through them. And so the people that are administering them are, you know, are healers, are, you know, wise women, wise people that are familiar with these processes and can sort of help usher you through it.
Oh, no, that's very reasonable, I would say. Sounds good to me. You've convinced me. So we're going to take another quick break now so that those listening can have an opportunity to top up their tea, but we will be back soon. Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully the teacups are now a little bit fuller again. Make sure to, you know, wait for it to cool down a bit. Don't scold yourself. So, Aaron, we did already introduce you in the first section of this episode, and we talked a little bit about kind of how you got into this topic, but maybe we can go into a bit more detail. So, I mean, you've mentioned a couple of different collaborators that you work with, but how big is the kind of archaeological tattoo community, I guess?
It is still pretty niche. You know, there's a core group of us that have been working on these questions for, you know, the past decade and some people for much longer than that. And, you know, we all know each other. It makes it very hard to do anonymous peer review.
Because you're like, oh, that's obvious.
Right, that's obviously Matt's paper, yes. So there are a very small number of people that are working full-time professionally in this. And, you know, I get calls constantly or inquiries from students, and they say, you know, how can I go into tattoo archaeology? And I'm like, well, you know, honestly, you can't. You know, like, I have the freedom to do tattoo archaeology because it is completely independent, because it's not part of my job. It doesn't have requirements on it. And So, you know, if someone wants to study this thing, the best advice I can give them is, you know, you need to pick a type of object or type of art and a region, and then go into it through that route. Because modern academia doesn't support the idea of like, I'm going to be a generalist.
Yep.
No. No. Bone tools from this one site in this one place.
Yeah. I must say, I have a lot of people ask me because I went the other route. I guess I specialized in a method, which is similar. Like, it's a very specific microarray analysis, a very specific method, right? And it's very specific materials that I look at as well. But then it does allow me to look at different regions, which is quite nice. So people are always, archaeologists are indeed always confused when they're like, but what's your cultural specialism? And I'm going, I don't really have one. I just look at tools from different things. But indeed, I'm still specialized in a method, which fits.
And that's the thing, right? I mean, it's how the academy is built. I mean, you can be an archaeologist of households, but when you actually then cut through that, you're going to have spent years knowing way too much about the households of this one particular region during this one particular period. And you know, there's information that translates when you start looking at the bigger picture, but you can't just go into it broadly. So that I think is where I've been really, really fortunate, is to sort of be able to do that independently.
In which case people are listening in and, you know, are thinking, no, but that sounds good, I want to do that. Do you have any kind of suggestions for maybe gaps in the current research in terms of specific tools, in terms of specific regions, or things that maybe someone might be able to pick for a dissertation topic or something like that?
Right. Well, I mean, there is still a lot of work waiting to be done. I think the problem for when you start talking about dissertations is, can you make a dissertation out of it?
Right.
And you know, there are a lot of, you know, I've run across a lot of people who, for, you know, undergraduate theses or undergraduate sort of summative papers, are doing things like, you know, tattooing in Egypt. And, you know, and that's great. That's, again, this sort of broad spectrum, you know, broad look at behavior within a region. But once they get to graduate school, if they want to pursue that specifically, you know, how many tools might there actually be? You know, how many collections can you actually get access to? You know, these are the sorts of questions that are going to sort of haunt you if you're trying to make a specific study of it. All
the practicalities. We're living the dream, Aaron.
Right.
I know that feeling as well. I had a similar experience where I was going, the Scottish carved stone walls, I'm going to look at them. And then Alison Sheridan, the lovely curator at the National Museum of Scotland, basically sort of said to me, but how many years do you have? Like, how many lifetimes do you have to look at this topic? It's like,
And, you know, that's what we're then sort of seeing is that, you know, new voices in this niche field are getting into it as related to their broader research. So they're finding things while they are working on other questions. And I think, but, you know, I think that's really the important thing. And that is sort of my goal, having gotten into this, was sort of to lift this veil a little bit and be like, well, you know, again, why weren't people doing it in the past? Well, how can we change it? Well, one of the ways we can change it is by having people look for it.
And in terms of that kind of idea that, you know, it's becoming a little bit more of a bigger topic, I mean, how is the study of tattoos or body modification in general, or other related topics or themes, is that sort of becoming less of a, I don't want to say taboo subject, because I wouldn't say it was necessarily taboo, but like more of a popular subject or more respected, I guess, as a subject in the academic archaeological community?
I think so. You know, I mean, well, so, you know, my anecdote that I tell, right, is that when I first got into this, you know, over a decade ago now, I had reached out to one of the, you know, very sort of senior scholars on Southeastern United States archaeology, and said, well, you know, I want to look at this with tattoos. And he kind of like, he harumphed at me and said something like, you know, there are more graduate students with tattoos of ancient art than there were tattooed people in the ancient world. and that, by the way, is example one for why we are not finding it.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. Because it's assumed that they were.
Right. Right. Yeah, because there's an assumption that it's just not there, or that it's, you know, whatever. It's right. Tattooing is for criminals and prostitutes and blah, 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 blah. So there's, you know, there's definitely a bias at work there. And, you know, anecdotally, the people that seem to be really interested in this are the younger generation, or people that are even younger than me. You know, I somehow have crossed that line where I'm not part of that generation anymore of younger scholars,
which kind of
mistakes,
old,
but yeah.
I'm going, wait, what? Yep. You're how old? I thought you were 12. Right.
No.
PhD? What?
And, you know, as far as reception wise, I mean, you know, when I give papers at conferences, I definitely from time to time feel this whole like, oh, here's Aaron talking about tattooing again. You know, but also like the hell with you, right? Like I, you know, yeah. I'm actually publishing on this. What are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. It's peer reviewed. It's, you know, it's valid research. It's, and yeah, it sounds like there's some exciting things coming about as well. So you mentioned that, you know, oh, there's more graduate students with tattoos than ancient tattoos. Do you think that in order to kind of, and like you say, you've already said that, you know, you don't necessarily approach it from the topic of I'm studying tattoos, you approach it from different ways. But would you say that in order to understand, I guess, the kind of older methods and techniques and experiences around tattooing, you have to either have tattoos yourself or have tattooed yourself? Or do you think that someone with no tattoos could also come in and do it?
Well, I mean, if we can't study it by doing it, then anthropology is out the window, right? like if we have to be a part of the culture to understand it, then we might as well just give up.
Yeah.
You know, that is what anthropology does, right? We're outside observers. We should be able to make this happen. But you know, in practice, not having that bias certainly helps. And I think looking back, that is a big change from the previous generation to my generation of scholars, was not necessarily having been tattooed, but being in a generation where tattooing was more commonplace. And so being able to look at, you know, look more sort of, I don't know, open, be more open in looking at these ideas and considering the past. And getting, you know, there was a lot of scholarship on tattoos in the anthropological community in the you know, the 1990s, but so much of it was, you know, modern primitives this, and, you know, social rejects that, and you know, like all these kinds of things.
You're sitting there going, hello.
Right.
With my hieroglyph on my arm.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's all the sociological studies about how, you know, if you have tattoos, then you're going to do drugs and die in a fire, right? Like there's a high statistical correlation there, you know, depending on who you talk to. But I think, you know, getting past those ideas was really important. So I don't think you yourself have to be tattooed, but I think you need to be open to these ideas. And I also think that people just need to do their reading. You know, I mean, that's the biggest thing when you look back at like the 18th and 19th and even early 20th centuries with people talking about or looking at tattoos in the past, is they're just very limited in their ideas of how the process was done, what the techniques were, what the tools were. They want everything to look like Samoa, right? That was quote unquote ancient tattooing as they knew it. And so they wanted everything to be hand tapped. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they wanted it to be done for reasons, you know, there's those, you know, those great accounts of the Emunet and the women from Deir al-Bahari, I believe it is, in Thebes, they're found in the 1900s. You know, high status women in the tomb, in the complex, funerary complex of a pharaoh, and are found to be tattooed. Huh. And this is around the turn of the century, I think. And, you know, the first discussion of these women is that, well, clearly they were concubines because they were tattooed. They were in service to the pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And right. So,
yes.
So being able to step away from those things is really, really important to understanding it.
Yes. Which, I mean, that's hopefully, if you've gotten that far in an archaeology or anthropology degree, I would hope that you already have learned a little bit about removing yourself from the bias of modern life anyway. But indeed, sort of.
Yeah. Although, again, the generation matters.
Yeah.
You know, people 40 years ago were learning a much different vision of, you know, the past than we learn today.
But it's good to hear that it's getting a bit more open and a bit more accepted, a bit more generally kind of talked about, I suppose, as well. If you're, I imagine you get a lot of people coming to you and saying, oh, I had this idea or something.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so. Right. I mean, I hope I'm not just shouting into the void here. Increasingly, again, this is where I'm really privileged to be able to do this as independent research, is increasingly I've sort of moving away from that academic discourse and instead trying to talk more to, you know, the tattoo community, to people who actually do this as their profession. Because, you know, tattooists are really interested in the history of their discipline, of their practice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And very few of them have access to journals that are behind paywalls.
Right.
And so I think it's, you know, it's really maybe even more important than sharing it with the academy is sharing what we know with people that are actually doing this and living this today.
Yeah, no, I could not agree more. I'm very, very much a pro of that one. And you mentioned the sort of that you're doing it obviously as independent research. And so obviously this isn't your day job, shall we say. It's sort of the extra work that you do when you have the time and funding, I presume. How do you manage to balance that kind of doing independent research with actually having a daily job?
Poorly. I think it kind of works like an ADHD thing with me, right? Like, it, you know, where like I get ideas in my head and they kind of just percolate there. And there's almost kind of a narrative that's running, you know, kind of running in the background on a low hum. And, you know, things will sit back there for a while. And then, you know, I'll even find myself like writing when I'm asleep, where, you know, I'll wake up and be like, oh, this is what that section of the paper should look like. And then, so, you know, if I can find the time to then bang that out, then it's great. You know, the reality of it is that my wife is very forgiving and supports me on this.
Same. Everyone always says, how do you manage to do all your different things? I'm like, because my husband is awesome.
Right. Because I have a great support network. That is the answer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which, no, I think that's but I can imagine there's so many people I know who have, you know, their projects and they're so passionate about it and they're so interested in it, but they just can't get the funding or they just can't actually get an academic position. So they go into a different job and then just don't have the time or the energy to do it. So I'm always curious to hear people who are managing to balance it and to combine it, how it works or doesn't work.
I think it's become my hobby, you know, and that is how I view it. And that's how then, you know, when I'm doing like, you know, these unfunded research trips to Germany to look at mummies in a museum, you know, like, you know, I don't get reimbursement for this. This is done on vacation time. There is no university funding. It's out of pocket, but it is my hobby. That's what I spend money on. You know, some people spend money on, you know, miniatures for wargaming. Some people spend them on bottles of whiskey. Some people spend them on tattooed mummies. It's what you're into. Yeah.
I can just imagine your wife going, oh, where are we going on the holiday this year? Oh, well, we're going to this. Where are the mummies? Like, what mummies? No, darling, we're definitely going on holiday this time.
No,
maybe have a day or two.
Those are days where I peel off and we do the things that we are separately interested in.
Nice. Yeah. That works. She can go and look at her Viking horned helmet or something. Her hobby. I think that it sounds like an excellent way to have a hobby and a really nice hobby in that respect. And in terms of kind of, I mean, we've already touched a little bit on the different kind of the not approach, the how it is viewed and all of that kind of thing. But are there any kind of other issues or are there any other what you would see it as advantages of kind of this more of a niche topic within kind of academic research?
Well, I mean, I guess the big advantage is that it doesn't seem like the well will ever run dry.
Right.
You know, I mean, I really thought, you know, in 2013, my first book, Drawing with Great Needles, which is about tattooing in ancient Eastern North America, came out. It's an edited volume. But, you know, at that time, I was kind of like, well, I've done that.
Yeah.
And then stuff just kept coming up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, you know, just having continued to try to keep a curious mind has done that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's definitely this kind of outsider status that in some ways benefits you, mm-hmm. where, you know, on one hand, I don't have a PhD. I don't have a university affiliation. On the other hand, I'm just some guy that's going to keep politely asking until they let me do the thing I want to do.
Well, and I would say, I mean, you were very modest at the start, but I would say, indeed, you have made a name for yourself now as the tattoo guy. You know,
well, I appreciate that.
Which, you know, so it's working. You're asking enough questions. But, and on that note, do you have any
kind of exciting plans or projects that are coming up. I believe this episode will be released end of February or mid to end of February.
Well,
if there's anything you're allowed to talk about by that point.
Right. So by the time this comes out, hopefully we, Danny and some others and I, will have a article in the European Journal of Archaeology about everyone's favorite tattooed Iceman.
Oh.
So hopefully that will be out in print.
Okay. In which case I'll share it in the show notes. So
that's right.
Check the show notes and then you'll be able to see if it came to fruition or not.
No, I mean, I'm excited about that one. That's one of those things that sort of, you know, ran around my head starting back during the pandemic and eventually just got the right team of people together to work on it. And so we're reassessing the sort of conventional wisdom as to how his tattoos may have been created.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. So that's coming out, and there's another paper or two that Danny and I are both working on related to similar topics to this idea coming out of our experimental archaeological study of, you know, can we look at preserved tattoos and talk about how they were actually made and sort of take the guesswork out of that process, make informed hypotheses. Yeah. The Oxford Handbook on the Archaeology of Body Modification will be coming out, is coming out already. It's sort of coming out online as chapters are finished, but it's going to be in print late next year. And that's going to be a huge book. That will have everything from, like, you know, genital mutilation to Andean tattooing in it. So,
wow, amazing. Oh, very cool. Yeah. That's joining the list of handbooks.
Yes, yeah. And so various colleagues and I have a couple of chapters in that, and it'll be good for those to see the light of day too. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Well, I'll make sure to share them as well. Anyone's interested, do keep checking the things. Any other final chance for any other plugs or, I don't know, declarations of passion for tattoos or anything?
No, I guess not. Follow me on the Instagram.
No, which is also in the show notes.
Right. Great. Yeah, but seriously, like, this is, you know, one of the big fulfillments and enjoyments I get out of doing this research is talking with people about it and sharing the information. And that's sort of why that Instagram account was created. And, you know, reach out, ask me questions. You know, folks should feel free anytime. There are no stupid questions. You know, we're all learning together. So yeah, reach out anytime.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming to chat to me today. I very much appreciate it. That marks the end of our tea break. It sounds like you've got a lot to get on with. You've got a whole, you know, topic to do. Thank you very much for joining me and chatting to me about tattoos today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
And if anyone else indeed wants to find out more about Aaron's work, history of tattoos, anything else we've talked about today, do check the show notes and there'll be Aaron's contact information there as well, so you can start bombarding him with all your questions about tattooing. And do not forget that for our APN members, there's also a special bonus episode coming out next week with Aaron and Danny together, who was the professional tattoo artist and guest from my last month's episode, to talk more about one of their recent collaborative projects. Hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you want to help support this show and all of the other amazing series that form the Archaeology Podcast Network, you can become a member. You get access to extra bonus content, such as this special bonus episode. You also get exclusive early access to ad-free episodes, and you also just help us to create even more amazing content. For more information, check out the homepage at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. See you next month. I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.